Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. We're so glad to have you with us here this evening on Ask Herbal Health Expert Susan Weed, a two-hour radio show each Tuesday night. Herbal medicine is people's medicine, simple, safe, effective. Please bring your curiosity and health questions. Susan will enlighten, surprise, and delight you. I know most of you know Susan Weed already. She's my mom, so I know her. But for those of you who have not yet met Susan, I'd like to share. She is the author of the Wise Woman Herbal Series, five wonderful books on women's health and herbal medicine, including Wise Woman Herbal for the Childbearing Year, Breast Cancer, Breast Health! The Wise Woman Way, Healing Wise, The Wise Woman Herbal, New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, and Susan's latest book, Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way. In addition to being the editor at Ash Tree Publishing and writing her books, Susan is the director of the Wise Woman Center in Woodstock, New York. The Wise Woman Center is open to the public on appointment-only basis. She offers weekend workshops, intensives, and apprenticeships throughout the season. Susan is also available to you online via wisewomanmentor.com. There you can go and view her weekly e-zine. You can subscribe to receive a notification via email each week, or you could join her mentorship program. Susan also offers distance learning correspondence courses and online courses at the Wise Woman University. But you can also just go to her website, susanweed.com, where you will find thousands of pages online with recipes, articles, art features, and so much more. Well, for now, let's see what Susan has to share with us this evening. Thank you, and welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much, Justine. I love you, my dearest, dearest daughter, and thank you for that marvelous introduction. How are you this evening, Rebecca?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Having some beautiful sunny days out here.
Well, we're kind of alternating between nice, sunny, you know, spring-type days with the bees buzzing, and days like today, kind of gray with a cold wind blowing across.
Yeah, we had 2 days of 70 degrees. It's like just amazing. It feels like summertime.
Is that usual for your spring to have temperatures in the 70s?
Yeah, we have, because we live pretty close to the coast, so it's pretty mild out here.
Yeah. Well, that means no radishes.
40 miles from the coast here.
Right, no radishes, no spinach. Because you have to have, like,
we can start planting them right now. And some of them are overwintered, like if you keep a cold frame up. And
Because once the temperatures get over 60, then the radishes and spinach never really become crops. They just flower.
I think that there are some varieties here that people do plant that they don't flower right away, because we do get
created for
so
your
many
climate.
Different hybrids out there these days.
Well, do we have anybody waiting on the phone, or should we go right to some emailed questions?
Nobody with a question on the phone, so let's go to an email question.
All right.
Dear Susan, your books are always so helpful for me. I usually answer questions for childbearing women. I have a question for you. After my miscarriage, I helped with herbs. Some tissue was left. I did a sonogram and blood test. I waited for my natural cycle, which started Monday on time with some brown bleeding, and it stopped. I have black, blue cohosh, and angelica. I started slowly from 5 drops every 2 hours. Today I'm doing 15 drops. What would be your advice to push retained tissue out? Acupuncture, acupressure, other herbs? Also, I can't find any information with doses for herbs, timing, etc., for retained tissue. I don't want a DNC. Thank you so much.
I miscarried once. I didn't think there was any retained tissue. There was no reason for me to think there was any retained tissue. It was on a Thursday, and I was due to drive down to Long Island to teach that weekend. And, of course, many of my girlfriends said, well, you have to just cancel that. You can't do it. And I said, well, what better place to go than to be with a whole group of midwives? I think it's the perfect place for me. And although, you know, I was emotionally upset and very sad physically, I felt fine. So I went down to Long Island and taught the midwives. And at the lunch break on Saturday, I said to one of them that I knew quite well, I said, you know, I just miscarried a few days ago. And I don't think there's any retained tissue, but a bimanual examination would really, you know, let us know more. And I can't do that myself. There's no way that I can do a bimanual on myself. She said, no problem. So we went up to a bedroom and you know, put some protection on the bed. And she checked me out and she said, no, your uterus seems, you know, small, it's tight, the cervix looks closed, everything looks fine. She said, it looked like you had a miscarriage. She said, and you're, you know, on your way to being past it. And I said, great. And that's pretty much what I felt, too. To be a little easier on myself rather than driving straight home, I had arranged to spend the night with some friends in Manhattan. So we drove, and we were out on Long Island, we drove into Manhattan. And on the drive there, I said to the person who was driving me, because I'd gotten someone to drive me again to give myself some ease, I said, please pull over there. And I went into the store, and I bought a package of Pepperidge Farm chocolate chip cookies. And I got back in the car, and Rebecca, I ate that entire package of cookies all by myself. I didn't even offer the woman who was driving me one. And I'm actually kind of like watching myself do this and go, that's pretty strange, Susan. It's not like you don't like a chocolate chip cookie, but usually one or two, you don't want any more. Look at you, one after the other, you're eating this. Very interesting. We find a place to park the car. It's, you know, 3 or 4 blocks from where we're going to be, but we find a place and we walk to where we're going to be, which is upstairs. It wasn't an elevator. It was up 5 flights of stairs. And as we got to the top of the stairs, I felt some mild cramping and went in the bathroom and went to the toilet and turned around, and there was a piece of placenta as big as the palm of my hand in the toilet. So I think the Pepperidge Farm chocolate chip cookies is the way to go, an entire package. And other than that, who else is helping you? Notice that I wasn't just being by myself. There were other women involved. There were other women around me. Let me give you even some more backstory here, because the first time I had a pregnancy end without coming to term, I bled and 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 knew next to nothing. And was massively infected and didn't know it, and had retained placenta and didn't know it, and tried to pretend that nothing had happened. And I wound up 5 days later in the hospital on intravenous antibiotics, being told by the doctor that if my friend had not taken a look at me, put me in a taxi, and taken me to the hospital, that I would have been dead by the next morning. I mean, I didn't feel great, but I didn't feel that bad. So know that even though you don't want a DNC, and I don't think I've ever met a woman who said that you really wanted a DNC, it's an invasive procedure, it might be something to just put at the end of the list. That's why there's the seven medicines. And invasive medicine is part of those medicines. And part of the reason that I created the seven medicines was because I was seeing people who would draw the line and say, no, I'm never going to have surgery, or no, I'm never going to have chemotherapy, and who chose death because of that. And I'm not against their choice, but I think we should really acknowledge that we have a choice. And that we do have a choice for invasive procedures, should it come to that. So the first medicine is Serenity Medicine. In this case, Serenity Medicine would involve meditating, taking time off from work, being slower, unplugging the cell phone, not answering the regular phone, really pulling back, pulling into yourself, and letting the great void and the great nothingness that is the inside of a woman who has miscarried, really letting that be. Letting it have its day in its fullness and its power. Sometimes, and I'm sure you've seen this as a midwife, sometimes what is needed to get the cervix to open is for the rest of the body to completely surrender. Serenity medicine. Can you surrender? I know you can. Do it. Story medicine. There are stories about miscarriage. I've told you a couple of stories about miscarriage. I've told you one story in which I almost died. And I've told you another story in which a professional midwife told me that there was no further product of conception in my uterus, and she was wrong. So, what is the story that you're telling yourself here? I don't know what it is. I'm not going to speculate about what it is. But it's important for you to know and to acknowledge that story and to see if there's any changes to that story that you desire, because you're the one creating the story. And then the third medicine is mind medicine or energy medicine. I often call this the shaman's playground. And here we have homeopathic remedies. We have energetic massage, hands-on healing, Reiki, that kind of thing. We have homeopathy and flower essences and gemstone elixirs. We have prayer and visualization and trance work. A lot of very powerful ways to engage in mind medicine. Some people call mind medicine the placebo effect. And I always say, isn't it wonderful that with a placebo we can get 50% of the problems that are encountered dealt with? Because basically a placebo means something that is harmless. So if I can get 50% of people better with something that's harmless, I am all for it. Is it possible that visualizing your cervix opening up, your uterus contracting, and this letting go, that that could help? The fourth river of healing is lifestyle. What are we eating? What are we drinking? How are we exercising? In a way, this is not very useful to the question that you ask. We're not going to spend much time here. There is a great divide that we have just come to. The first four medicines, serenity medicine, story medicine, mind medicine, and lifestyle medicine, build health. Whether or not they resolve our problems, they build health. And one of the best ways to use them is to set a time limit. We're not going to say, hey, why don't you try serenity medicine, see if you can get this out of your womb and wait for a year. No, that's not a reasonable time limit. You have to set time limits for each one of these steps as you engage in them. The great divide here is between those first four medicines and the last three medicines, alternative medicine, pharmaceutical medicine, and high-tech medicine. And those three medicines always erode our health, just as the first four medicines always build health, whether they get rid of the problem or not. The last three medicines always erode health, even if they get rid of the problem. So you're asking me questions about alternative medicine, about taking blue cohosh and black cohosh. Blue cohosh contains oxytocin. And oxytocin, taken in large enough doses, causes uterine contractions. Black cohosh counters the effect of the blue cohosh. Cohosh being a little confusing here, but it is a word that merely means root. So blue cohosh and black cohosh are no more alike than an apple and a banana. They grow in different places. They have different actions. They are often used together depending on the reason for using the blue cohosh. If what you are looking to do is to get strong uterine contraction going, then what I do in a situation like that is to just use blue cohosh. Once I get the contractions that I want going, if the woman is complaining of pain, then black cohosh can be used as an antispasmodic and a painkiller to help relieve that pain. A dropperful dose of blue cohosh every hour is a moderate dose. A dropperful of blue cohosh every 15 to 20 minutes would be a extreme dose. It is said that it's possible to push the blood pressure up by taking too much blue cohosh. We haven't seen that. We did a few very small trials of it and didn't see it even at extreme large doses. The brown blood that you saw is simply oxidized blood. So it's not new material. The blood can't become brown inside the uterus. It can only become brown once it's exposed to oxygen, which means outside the uterus. What can happen is the uterus can expel red blood, but it can sit in the upper part of the vagina and oxidize there and become brown. It can even, in some instances, become very dark. And then when there is a bowel movement or urination, that darkened, oxidized blood can be expelled. So that's alternative medicine. Also in my book, Childbearing Year, which I'm sure you have, the starred herbs are the ones that contain oxytocin. Some women sometimes use several of them together to try to get uterine contractions going. And there is a chapter on initiating uterine contraction that will give you more information. But I'm going to end with a question that I would have asked first thing if you'd been on the telephone with me, and that is, do you know for a definite fact that there's product of conception still in your uterus? I hope this has been helpful. Green blessings.
All right. There's a caller waiting in the 510 area code.
Hello, hello everybody. Thank you so much for having me on your show. My question tonight is about a diagnosis that I got back in the summer of 2013, during which I was diagnosed with herpes simplex 2, the genital version of herpes, and had a massive outbreak at the time and went on the antibiotics until it was under control, and since then I've been exploring more natural and spiritual ways to deal with this virus in my body and in my life. And so I wanted to call to see, Susan, what your thoughts are, not only on what herbs there are to use with something like this, but also your perspective on the body has been so enlightening and helpful to me. And this dealing with this has really been I would say a full-on battle with my body and the negativity that's come into my life because of it and that I've been putting on myself and that has come up in my relationship. And when you talk about how we wage war on our bodies and how we look at disease and whatnot, that so rings true with this situation. And so I wanted to hear your thoughts on some herbal suggestions and also your perspective on this specific virus.
Well, let me start by telling you that the first outbreak is usually the worst.
Yes.
And that for a significant number of people, there are never again any further outbreaks.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't have to be the beginning of something terrible.
Mm-hmm.
It can be what it is and was. I have never heard of antibiotics being effective against a virus. Antibiotics are antibacterials.
Mm. Oh, you're right.
They have no effectiveness. I am supposing that you were given an antiviral.
Yes, I must be incorrect. Absolutely.
Yeah, like one of the cyclovirs.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, those are antivirals, because antibiotics would be completely useless.
It would be, right.
Antibiotics, simply cannot deal with the virus at all. So
right.
I have just walked in the other room and gotten my copy of Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way. And we have gone to the chapter on, yes, indeed, we're looking for, here we go, I'm looking for the section on sexually transmitted disease here, pelvic inflammatory, that's not what we want, fibroids, endometriosis, heavy bleeding, all good topics, but not what we're looking for. And it, here we go. Yes, indeed. Syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, herpes. All right. Here we go. So here's our help box. Expect results in 2 to 4 days. Apply St. Joan's wort oil to all sores as often as possible. 2, take a dropperful of St. Joan's wort tincture 4 to 8 times a day. 3, supplement with L-lysine. Have you been doing any of those things?
I have not tried those two, no. I actually,
okay.
In the past, I took St. John's wort for other things, so it's interesting to hear you suggest it for this, too.
It's an antiviral.
Well, there you go. Okay.
Genital herpes hides in the nerves down there.
Right, yeah.
Major change, desired or not, fatigue, trauma, excessive exposure to sunlight, new job, new home, new relationship, travel, surgery, tight clothes can trigger the virus to create lesions. So I will say that for most people in good health, the herpes becomes a red light.
Hmm.
So long as you're not stressed, you're not going to feel it or hear from it. You start stressing yourself, it's going to start acting up.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, what a blessed angel it is, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. in case there's any doubt.
Mm-hmm. Avoid nuts during herpes outbreak, especially hazelnuts, Brazil nuts, peanuts, walnuts, and almonds, which contain large amounts of arginine, which is an amino acid that worsens the symptoms. I have seen several situations in which people took an infusion of burdock and echinacea root.
Yes,
and that's using an ounce of burdock root and an ounce of echinacea root in a quart jar, filling it to the top with boiling water and drinking 1 to 2 cups a day for at least 6 weeks. I've worked with women, this is not so much true anymore, but it used to be true, that if a woman had herpes on a blood test, that they would demand that she do a C-section.
Wow.
And so I worked with women so that they could get a clear blood test. In other words, herpes couldn't be seen in the blood.
Mm.
Now, whether or not it was completely gone from the body, we never knew. But we could certainly get them at that point using 1 to 2 cups of burdock echinacea root infusion daily for 6 weeks. It's expensive. And you may not need to go to that extreme.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I would say just in general is that raw food weakens the immune system.
Mm.
And if you're concerned, I would avoid raw food. And essential oils weaken and can ruin the immune system. And this takes a bit of doing to get all essential oils out of your environment and out of your body.
Mm-hmm.
Because essential oils are in toothpaste, they're in mouthwash, they're in shampoo, they're in nice soap.
Wow. Wow. I'm curious, too, what your thoughts are on the idea that that this virus can be spread without, you know, when there's not an overt outbreak of it, but this idea that maybe all the time one might be contagious in that sense and able to spread it without any warning or awareness?
Herpes comes from the Greek word to creep. I'm reading from the book. The virus creeps into the nerves through the skin. Most easily through a cut or a tear. Once inside, it migrates to the spine where it lurks, awaiting sufficient stress to activate it into an eruption of painful lesions. Vaginal, anal, and oral sex, even with protection, can pass genital herpes to a partner, and herpes can be spread even in the absence of sex.
Right.
It requires only bare skin contact to transmit. So it doesn't say specifically if it has to be an outbreak, but it sounds to me like there doesn't have to be.
Right.
Genital herpes infects about 25% of adults in the USA and Europe, and there's 1 million new cases annually in the U.S. You are not alone.
No. No.
You are not a bad person. You are, dare I say it, not being punished by God. You could have gotten genital herpes from someone by hugging them when you were both wearing bathing suits. It doesn't require sex. And it doesn't require careless sex. Is that helpful to you?
That is, yeah. That's very helpful. I appreciate your insight, Susan. Thank you very much for both of your time tonight.
You are welcome. Green blessings.
To you as well.
Okay, we're going to go on to an email question.
All right.
All right. Hi, Susan. I read in your forum about puncture wounds on cats. The closest I could come to an answer about a cat bite my son received. It was a stray cat, and it got him pretty good. Two bites on his hand, one on his finger that is swollen badly. He's been putting peroxide on it and went to a doctor, who of course wanted to give him antibiotics, and I told him I would try to see if I could find an alternative. All I found was you, so I'm thinking garlic, vitamin D3, E, echinacea, maybe zinc, and Pas de Arco. Anything else you can recommend? I don't think the peroxide will do him much good on a puncture wound because I'm worried about the possible infection internally that peroxide could not reach topically. Thank you very much.
If you were on the phone, I would be screaming at you. So let me say it clearly and loudly, and I hope that everyone can hear me. Never, ever put hydrogen peroxide on a wound. When you put hydrogen peroxide on a wound and you see the bubbles, that is the destruction of cells. It is not recommended to put hydrogen peroxide on a wound. When I grew up, what was put on a wound was iodine. And it was similarly discovered that iodine was certainly a disinfectant, but it was a disinfectant that killed cells and made wounds much harder to heal. So please throw away your hydrogen peroxide, although I don't know, I think maybe you can clean like stainless steel or something with it. I really don't know. I'm not a cleaning expert, so don't quote me on it, but please, not in your medicine chest. One of the best first aids in your medicine chest for any kind of puncture wound or any kind of wound that you want to pour hydrogen peroxide on, instead, put yarrow tincture on it. If you don't have yarrow tincture in your first aid kit, I suggest you make some or buy some. It is one of my favorites. And science backs it up. Science can show us a list of gram-negative and gram-positive bacteria that yarrow kills on contact. You could, at this point, because we're kind of talking in the past now, but what do you do first aid? And this, of course, is way past first aid at this point. You can start soaking these wounds. Whenever there is a puncture wound, whenever there is a deep wound, the wound needs to be soaked. It needs to be kept as wet as possible. I like to do hot soaks, but if the wound is really inflamed and red, then cold soaks can be more soothing. A nurse friend of mine brought me as a gift a bottle of Ivory dishwashing liquid, and I looked at her and I said, why on earth are you bringing this to me? And I like opened, you know, the cupboard under my sink, and I said, look, you know, I use this like nice, you know, organic kind of soap. It's not really organic, but, you know, kind of a new age dishwashing soap. I said, and here you're bringing me Ivory? And she said, this is the best thing for soaking anything, any kind of bite, scratch, wound. She said, and you walk barefoot, and you're always getting things in your feet. And she said, I want you to have this on hand. She said, you just put a squirt of this in a tub of hot water, and you soak your feet in there. The next time you get something in there, and you'll see. I'm like, oh, come on, you know. I can throw a piece of seaweed in the water or some salt in the water. And she said, no, you try this. And I don't know what's in it. It maybe there's some surfactant or something. But it just kind of opens the wound up and allows things to come out of the wound. It's really quite amazing. So you might want to have some of that in your first aid kit as well. Echinacea tincture internally is not a bad idea. Anytime you think there's a risk of bacterial infection, echinacea tincture internally, I think, is a good idea. If you don't have it, you could use that yarrow tincture, which you're putting on the wound outside. You could also take that inside as well to help counter infection. I talk about the use of both yarrow and echinacea in most of my books and go into quite a bit of detail about using them in down there. I find the best results with echinacea come from quite large doses, and those doses taken pretty frequently. So if your child who got scratched by this cat is now at a place where healing seems to be going along pretty well, then take his body weight divided by half, and that number is the number of drops he would take, and he could take that number of drops every 4 to 6 hours. If, on the other hand, things are not going along well and your child is feverish or there's redness or swelling or streaks of red from any of these wounds, then you would use that same dose of echinacea. That's half of his body weight is the number of drops you use, but you would use it every hour or two, depending on how severe the infection is. Again, remember, there are seven medicines, and one of those is pharmaceutical medicine. And if it has been progressing very, very rapidly, then sometimes pharmaceutical medicine is the right choice to make. We certainly don't want to see long-term damage to your child. So herbs work, and herbs work well, but the sooner we use them, the better they work. And, of course, I have no way of knowing how long ago this was, so I've tried to give you a variety of options for going forward. Also want to say I do have an online course on herbal first aid, and, you know, it's a small investment in your peace of mind and your family's peace of mind, because you learn about the plants that are growing right around you that can be used for first aid. You develop your own first aid kit, so when something like this happens, you don't have to, shall we say, start from scratch. You have that yarrow tincture right on hand. You have the echinacea, and be sure you get it without any golden seal, right there, and you're ready to go with first aid. The sooner we use it, the better our results are going to be. Great blessings.
All right. We have a return question here from a woman that wrote in a couple of weeks ago, and answered her question concerning an ultrasound and a CAT scan that discovered a 22-centimeter solid mass in her ovary and an enlarged uterus, and she went in for an extensive abdominal surgery, and she wrote back saying, "Dear Susan, thank you so very much for your excellent advice you gave me regarding surgery. It really helped. My prayers were answered, and the doctor was able to just remove the large football-sized fibroid tumor and didn't have to take anything else. I'm so grateful. What is your opinion on what causes fibroids? Do you feel there needs to be more education for menopausal women to help prevent fibroids? Thank you again, and many blessings."
What good news. I am so happy to hear that. That is absolutely wonderful. So I'm glad I got the copy of Down There, because once again, I'm looking in Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way, and I'm looking at the chapter on fibroids. And fibroids are so common that I usually start off by saying fibroids are not a disease. Fibroids are only a problem if they're a problem. Between the ages of 35 to 50, about 20% of white women and nearly 60% of women of color will have uterine fibroids. By the age of 50, more than 80% of black women and 70% of white women will have fibroids. So how can we define something that that many women are dealing with as a disease? It's simply not. Now, granted, fibroids can cause problems. They can lean on the bladder and cause incontinence. They can lean on the bowel and cause bowel problems. They can cause bleeding. They can cause hemorrhage. I'm not saying that they can't cause problems, but I am saying that first and foremost, fibroids are not the problem. And
some fibroids grow and some fibroids shrink and some fibroids stay the same, and there's really no way to tell whether a fibroid is going to grow or shrink. I'm so glad that your surgeon was able to simply remove the fibroid. And we know that they do run in families. And so the real answer to your question is kind of a weird answer, and that is what causes fibroids may be a mutated gene that interferes with the production of fumarate hydratase. Now, are we any smarter than we were before? No, because that's kind of a meaningless thing to us. That's what causes fibroids. Well, that's determined well before you're born, those genetic influences, isn't it? Fibroids have many estrogen receptors, but estrogen, even in birth control pills or in estrogen replacement, does not cause fibroids, and a low estrogen diet will not cure or prevent fibroids, as I have seen some books and articles claiming that women are estrogen dominant and that's what's causing their fibroids and they have to use progesterone cream to counter that. Cannot find any evidence of any kind that is true. In fact, there's a lot of really good evidence that progesterone will increase the size of fibroids. So I think it, I don't know, disingenuous for people to say that countering estrogen dominance with progesterone will help women who are dealing with fibroids, when in fact the only evidence that we have linking hormones to fibroids is progesterone increases the size of the fibroid. Again, progesterone doesn't cause the fibroid. And so far, we haven't found any particular hormonal cause for fibroids, but progesterone will increase their size. Researcher Karen Hartman says, women should relax about big fibroids. Those are old and dormant. It is the small ones that they have to worry about. And interestingly enough, women who have had four or more children or women who smoke are the ones least likely to have fibroids. Fibroids, as we know, usually go away after menopause. Women who began menstruating before they were 12, women who are obese, and women who have not given birth are more likely to have problems with their fibroids. So do I think that women need to be educated more? Well, I guess so. I'm sure that's why, you know, at least part of why I wrote down there, sexual and reproductive health. And I start the chapter on fibroids out. Recent findings from nearly a million counseling sessions conducted by the HERS Foundation suggest that almost all hysterectomies could be avoided with either conservative treatment or no treatment at all. Every year in America, a quarter of a million women have their uterus removed due to fibroids. You were not one of them. About 80% of women with uterine fibroids have few or no symptoms. You weren't necessarily one of them either. I am so glad that you wrote back and that you have had such great success. Green blessings.
Okay, let's go to another email question. Hello, Susan. I am a student at the Assisi Institute, and I am doing research on the wise woman archetype. Do you have any source suggestions for the wise woman tradition? The work you are doing sounds fascinating, and Woodstock is in driving distance of where I live in Ridgefield, Connecticut. I recently stayed in Woodstock when I attended a workshop with Dr. Louis Mel Madrona. Thank you.
The best reference would be Healing Wise, my big green book, in which I talk about the wise woman tradition, the heroic tradition, and the scientific tradition. To my knowledge, and I certainly could be wrong, but to my knowledge, this is the first time the wise woman tradition was named as such, described, and written about at all. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't other references. There are other books. I think Susan Cahill has a book called The Wise Woman. Certainly Jean Shinoda Bolen's work on goddesses and every woman. There are so many mothers and grandmothers, aunties, sisters that have helped me along the way in reclaiming the wise woman tradition. But I am the voice of the wise woman tradition, and I certainly hope that we have an opportunity to talk, that you come up and join me either for the Easter Work Exchange weekend or perhaps for the weekend after that, in which I'm going to be doing a spring tonics class and a hands-on spring medicines. So we're going to be making nettle soup and wild salad. Dream blessings.
Okay, next question. Hello, Susan. I have a question regarding familial hypercholesterolemia. This runs in my family, and my doctor has been trying to get me to take statins for years. I actually gave in a couple of times years ago and took Lipitor for a short time. It did lower the numbers, but I don't like taking drugs and haven't taken them for years. I am a 50-year-old female. I got a test for C-reactive protein to test for inflammation, and that level was okay. I also recently heard of testing homocysteine for plaque buildup, which I will ask my doctor about as well. I recently have been getting what I think is xanthulasma near the corner of my right eye. It looks like fatty tissue, kind of looks like a little worm under the skin and is raised. I also have lipoma on my right forehead, one at the back of my right shoulder and one at the inside middle of my lower right leg. As far as I know, the lipomas are not related to cholesterol. I am wondering if I should be taking something for my cholesterol. I started drinking herbal infusions about a month ago and rotate between red clover, nettles, oat straw, linden flowers, and comfrey. I read in one of your books that dandelion is good for cholesterol, and I'm wondering if I should start drinking dandelion infusions as well. I have been a vegetarian for 24 years and sometimes have been vegan. Since listening to you and beginning to read your books, I have started eating fish and yogurt and cooking my vegetables more. Any help would be greatly appreciated. I am hooked on listening to your Blog Talk radio show. Thank you for all your work, and thanks for sharing. I am confused about whether my high cholesterol is causing any ill effects inside my body, wondering if there are any tests I could take or what you might recommend in the way of treating naturally with herbs. More information about myself if you need it. 5'7 and 125 pounds. I do a lot of walking and some yoga and other forms of exercise. My blood pressure is good. I passed my stress test and used to smoke but have quit. Smoked a pack a day as a teenager and then had been on and off smoking for years. And that is the extent.
Okay, well, I am looking at an article here. And it's pretty new, so I haven't had a chance to go back to the original research. But this is a report on the research from the New York Times. After four decades of warnings that saturated fats should be avoided in healthy diets, new research is casting doubt on that claim. An extensive new analysis of nearly 80 studies involving 660,000 people, that's well over half a million people, has found no evidence linking the fats found in meat, butter, and cheese to an increased risk of heart disease. Researchers also found no firm evidence that unsaturated fats, such as the omega-3 fatty acids in salmon, can reduce heart disease rates. These are interesting results that encourage careful reappraisal of our current nutritional guidelines, says researcher Rajiv Chaudhary at the University of Cambridge. Saturated fats increase LDL, or bad cholesterol, but the new findings suggest that the relationship between cholesterol and heart disease is far more complicated than previously thought. Researchers did confirm, however, that the much maligned trans fats, the partially hydrogenated oils found in processed foods, have a direct link to heart disease. So, let's see if we can make small words out of big words. The first big word that we were introduced to was a big word that means that your family has high levels of cholesterol. That for whatever reason, your family produces a lot of cholesterol. In my experience, I find this quite a lot with people of Mediterranean extraction. My guess, and it's just a wild, wacky guess, is that there's something about the liver's ability to make a lot of cholesterol that is very useful when you're living in a very hot, very dry climate, like around the Mediterranean, Italy, Greece, and those kinds of places. We know that someone with low or normal cholesterol levels and high inflammatory markers is far more likely to have a heart attack than someone with high cholesterol and low to normal inflammatory markers. So I am feeling at ease that your C-reactive protein is in a normal range. I'm feeling at ease that you are physically active. I'm feeling at ease that you're drinking infusions, especially linden infusion, which we know can bring down C-reactive protein, and which, like the red clover, contains phytosterols, which can be used to hormonally support and help the heart. One thing you didn't mention was whether or not your family has a history of heart attack. That would be interesting to know. We know that you have a history of high cholesterol. In my sweetheart's case, his family has a history of high cholesterol. His usual total cholesterol is about 400. And the men in his family were dropping dead of heart attacks. Absolutely. But it wasn't from the cholesterol. Interestingly enough, so the kind of cholesterol that your body is making, first of all, is different from the cholesterol in food. So you need to also understand that those are somewhat different cholesterols, even though the cholesterol in food is now being completely, you know, reprieved of any possible sin in our bodies. What forward thinkers think is that cholesterol is repair material, and that when the blood vessels are damaged, cholesterol comes in and puts a patch on it. Now, if you think about a bicycle tire that's gotten damaged and you put a patch on it, that patch is going to go flip-flap, flip-flap. And so it's going to repair it, but it's not going to be perfect. And that's the problem there. This cholesterol is doing what it's supposed to do, but it's not perfect. And in the worst kind of situation, that patch can come undone. And if that cholesterol patch comes undone, it can cause a stroke or a heart attack because it's a clot now. So it's not the cholesterol's fault that that is happening, and we can't show that having high cholesterol causes those cholesterol plaques to form. What we can show is that damage to the blood vessels is what causes those cholesterol plaques to form. And the one thing that I'm completely uneasy about, as you know, is your diet. I see that you are improving your diet. Hooray. Thank you so much. I believe that in order for a human being to be optimally healthy, and especially for our blood vessels to be healthy, that we need to have some good quality red meat in our diet. We don't have to go overboard. I'm not talking about three times a day. I'm not even talking about three times a week. But some red meat in the diet provides nutrients for the liver and the immune system that just aren't found anywhere else. If there is a connection between meat and disease like cancer, heart attack, so on, that link seems to be with processed meat, sausage, salami, hot dogs. You know what I'm talking about. So the last thing I wanted to say is that homocysteine is a very important marker of inflammation. However, the blood test is pretty inaccurate. In scientific studies, they use very expensive tests, usually hair tests, that at this point are not available through your doctor. So you could have your homocysteine checked, certainly. But whether or not the results would be anything that you could, shall we say, bank on, your C-reactive protein is normal or low, I think that's good enough. Right now, I wouldn't worry about your cholesterol. If I were you, I wouldn't take a statin drug. As a matter of fact, you've heard me say it before, and you're going to keep hearing me say it. I haven't seen any evidence of any kind ever that women's lives are improved or lengthened by taking statin drugs, even women who've already had a heart attack. Green blessings.
All right. Next question. Hello, Susan. My uterus is killing me, but the doctors say I'm healthy and they can't seem to find anything wrong. I will back up a bit. I'm a mother of three living children, and my body has produced seven altogether. I have never had problems up until about 6 years ago with pains in my uterus, legs, bleeding that was on or off. I would freak thinking I was pregnant again, even though I was on birth control. Headaches, weight gain, and mood swings. Sometimes so bad I can't stand myself. I will swell in my fingers and feet to the point it hurts. I also have sciatica. Now for years I've tried stretching and drinking lots more water, eating better and working out. Well, these last 2 years the pain has gotten to the point that I can't even sit, walk, or try to lay in bed with my husband. The pains will just hit me and will jump or almost drop me to my knees. My family will rub my back to hold me till I start feeling a little better. The pain will last for a few seconds to 30 minutes. Sex, I can't even think of that because when I do, oh no, more pain. Yes, I have had terrible pain during intercourse the last 2 years with my husband. I have tried drinking raspberry leaf, Vitex tree berry tea. I go for a massage and have done acupuncture as well. I thank you for taking the time to read this when you do and giving me any advice for helping me regain my womanhood.
Very difficult to do via email. In this situation, I very much feel that I really need to hear this woman and speak with this woman and make a personal contact with this woman. There are obviously a lot of things going on here. And with some of the questions that we've been working with, I don't mind kind of, you know, taking a guess here or a guess there. But in this, it just doesn't feel in my heart like I want to make any guesses at all. So I'm going to ask if there's any way at all that you could call and actually talk to me. And if you feel uncomfortable with the idea of calling and talking on the Blog Talk Show, then, Rebecca, will you email her with other options?
Yes, I can do that.
Thank you so much. I very much need to talk to you so that we can talk about this. Green blessings.
All right. We have somebody that's calling that's on the phone.
Okay.
In the 541 area code.
Hi, thanks, Susan. So thankful that you do this. I just enjoy it so much and just really respect that you take time away from nature to do this for us all.
Thank you so much. You notice I do it after dark.
I love it. I feel like I'm just chatting with you. I was the old student that called about the essential oils, and I'm actually teaching a massage class coming up here in an hour, and I wanted to give the students alternatives to essential oils and talk about making our own massage creams and healing oils.
What a great idea. Mary Rose wrote an article for one of the your big slick massage magazines sometime back now, maybe even 15, 16 years ago, on natural scent therapy.
Uh-huh.
Lavender is used often in massage oils. If you want the scent of lavender in a room, could you put a lavender plant in the room and touch the lavender plant?
I plant lavender everywhere I can.
And all you have to do is brush by it to get the smell, right?
Yeah.
So, and lavender is very happy to grow in a pot. And it can be brought right into the massage room. And the hands of the masseuse can be passed through the lavender plant, actually getting some of the volatile oils onto that person's hands. Natural scent therapy. Now, this can be done with other plants as well, can't it? Thyme, rosemary, lemon balm, peppermint. Most of these plants are have their origin in the Mediterranean basin, where soils are sandy and shallow, so these plants are happy to grow in pots. And think about it. If we use a lavender plant for one massage, we could still use it for another one, couldn't we? It's not like we have to throw it out after we've done one massage with it. Whereas the lavender plant that went into making that essential oil was not harvested in a way that the plant would live. The entire plant was cut down. And I've asked around. I really don't know the answer to the question of how many pounds of lavender in a one-ounce bottle of oil, but the lowest answer I got was 1,000 pounds. And we think about what one lavender plant we could use over and over, week after week, month after month. Now, some people who do this say, well, Susan, the truth of the matter is I have three or four lavender plants. That way I can have one in my massage room and three outside soaking up the sun. And then after a massage, they put the one they use back out in the sun and bring a new one into the room, because to them that like kind of makes a psychic break and an energetic break so that there's something fresh for the next person.
Good one.
And, you know, but, I'm the kind of person who kind of likes, you know, consistency. So I'm like, yeah, but it's my hands and my lavender, and so I want the same one because we're working up a relationship here. So, you know, either way, it's just different kinds of personalities there. You can also put a variety of things into a pan of steaming water, which will scent the air like orange peel. Cinnamon sticks.
I trim a little lavender, a little sage, a little oregano, a little thyme, and I simmer them gently, and then I strain that and put towels in them. And wring them out, and then I'll put the hot towels on people as a
Beautiful! Wow! Oh, that's gorgeous! Natural scent therapy. There's so many ways that we can make use of the natural scents around us. And there's a woman named Kumba, K-U-apostrophe-U-M-B-A, and she puts out a line of natural scent therapy. Coconut oils, and she has simply infused herbs into the coconut oil. And, of course, coconut oil has this wonderful property that it's solid at room temperature but melts at body temperature.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful, wonderful for massage. And I especially thought of that because you were talking about with your students making massage lotions. And so that's a really easy, you're already like picking these herbs that you're simmering in water. Those same herbs, instead of putting them in water, you could put them in coconut oil. You have to keep it just warm enough to keep the coconut oil liquid and let it infuse for several weeks and then use that as a massage lotion.
Yeah, I've started to move from olive oil with my red oils and stuff to coconut because of some of the smell issues and textures and, yeah.
Yeah, I like them both. I'm certainly happy to have them both. And I've, you know, ever since I read a comment by Hildegard of Bingen about making an ointment for someone with a lump in her breast from the belly fat of a young male goat, I have worked more and more with using animal fats as the basis for my ointments and applications because those animal fats themselves carry hormonal properties that are very healing. The, you know, fat around the kidneys contains cortisol, and, which acts like cortisone when it's applied dermally.
Oh, I love it. I love the thought of using tallow and the ancient fat sources like that. Yeah.
Yes, and especially now that American small farming has been revived and been revived because of animal husbandry and because more and more people of good heart are eating good-hearted meat, you can actually find someone and specify what organ and what animal you want the fat from and have a chance of getting it.
Can I ask you one more quick question, Susan?
Sure.
So I was in a really bad car accident, and I was the only one that didn't break bones, but my bones are still sore after 4 or 5 months. I've tried different therapies, acupuncture, massage, you know, different treatments, but it almost feels like my bones are bruised.
Yes.
Humphrey's definitely one of my favorite friends, you know, and that I
have you been working with it?
You know, it's just arrived from the garden recently, so I started picking it again. Yeah, I'm a big fan of eating it every day. I nibble on a little bit.
I think that's great, but you can't consume nearly as much that way as you do if you dry it and make an infusion.
Yeah,
let's,
I haven't.
Let's face it, anything you're eating raw, you're getting maybe 0.5% of the nutrients in it. There's no nutrition in raw food, and nothing in nature eats raw food.
Yeah, I remember the little exercise you did with us at James where you had us put our arms together as cell walls and talk about how the cell wall doesn't break down.
Exactly. So you can nibble on comfrey, but it's not going to do what you want, which is to heal your bones. That's why comfrey is called nib bone. So get some dried comfrey leaf or dry some of your comfrey leaf. And I harvest my comfrey leaf when it is in flower.
Oh.
And that allows me to get the maximum amount of allantoin from it, which is the healer that we're looking for, right?
I didn't know that, the flower.
Yeah, so that's why I wait until there's a stalk before I harvest it.
Mm-hmm.
And drying it, you recall, breaks down that cell wall. And so that's where we're really going to get the nutrition.
I've been thinking about you saying that to me as I walk around and pick the spring greens and eat them, the little miner's lettuce and the chickweed and the dandelion flowers and all those things I love to eat in the spring. I've been thinking about you.
They're wonderful to eat, and I have nothing against your eating them.
Uh-huh.
But you're not getting nutrition from it.
Mm.
Right? 1 ounce of dried comfrey leaf is 4 ounces, a quarter pound of fresh comfrey.
Mm.
So suppose that you could get 100% of the nutrition from raw comfrey. You can't, but suppose you could. You'd have to eat a quarter of a pound of fresh comfrey to get the same nutrition you'd from drinking a quart of infusion.
Well,
you're quite correctly saying you nibble on it. Let's face it, comfrey's hairy. It's not fun to eat. Hey, and I, again, I don't want to discourage you from going around and nibbling. Please do that. Now, whether or not that's getting you in good with the plants, ooh, that's another thing altogether. I was just watching a PBS special called What Plants Talk About. And it says that plants, as we know, communicate in a great many ways. But something that I hadn't really realized is that plants communicate by smells. They actually create odors that communicate. And the narrator was saying that smell of new mown hay, that smell of cut grass, that is a plant signal of, oh, help, help, help. That smell, we say, oh, that smells so good, that's a plant's panic call. So whether or not the plants are going, oh, no, here he comes again, or whether they're going, ah, here's this wonderful person, I can't tell you. But do see it from a plant's viewpoint, and that is that if you are indeed nibbling or tearing the leaves, you are making a more jagged wound than if you simply harvested it with a scissors or a knife.
Mm-hmm.
Or as I often say to people, if you were going to give your arm away to someone who could use it, would you rather they tore it off or cut it off?
That's a good one.
So comfrey, I think, will really help you. And I think it needs to be as an infusion from dried comfrey, 1 ounce of dried comfrey, in a quart jar filled to the top with boiling water, tightly lid it, allowed to steep overnight, and then the liquid poured off. Don't bother to strain the comfrey. Put the wet comfrey in a saucepan. Put 2 cups of cold water on it. Bring it to a boil. Turn the fire off. Let it steep for 4 to 6 hours. And strain that second brew. This time squeeze the comfrey. Especially if you have comfrey that you've harvested with the stalk, you will feel the allantoin, which is kind of slippery, coming out of it.
Yeah.
So do a double brew on comfrey. Don't bother with things like nettle. You're not going to get anything the second time. But with comfrey, the allantoin is more soluble in the cold water, and so we get more of it in our second brew.
Wow. Great.
Yeah. Well,
thank
thanks for asking.
Okay, we have 2 callers waiting on the line, so I'm going to cut in here.
Okay, let's go on to those callers.
All right, in the 603 area code.
Hi, Susan. Thank you so much for doing this.
You're welcome.
Really wanting to ask you advice for quite some time. I'm looking for your help with my extreme anxiety and stress. I'm going through major life changes in the days ahead, and I'm looking to avoid prescription drugs if possible. I'm 63 years old. You should know, please, before answering that, for the last 3 weeks since I started listening to you, I've tried red clover, nettles and oat straw infusion, but I don't know if you would approve of what I've been doing. What I've been doing is I've been doing 2 of the infusions a day. First, I've been on alternating days. I've been doing either red clover or the nettles, sipping the 3.5 cups throughout the a.m. through the afternoon. And when that's done, I move on to the 3.5 cups of the oat straw infusion in the evening up to bedtime. And that's what I've been doing. And I was also wondering if I should be considering possibly hops or hawthorn or any other suggestions that you may have for me I deeply appreciate it.
I don't want to push you to reveal anything that you don't want to reveal, but I couldn't quite catch what's going on. So here's what I heard, and maybe I wasn't listening well, but what I heard was, I'm a 63-year-old woman who's going to be going through major life changes, and I want to avoid having to take drugs. And right away I'm going, well, wait a second. I know lots of people who've gone through major life changes and aren't taking drugs. Why on earth would she think that going through a major life change would make her need to take drugs?
May I answer that the best I can to help you?
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. The extreme anxiety and stress that I have had most of my life has worsened recently, and I was on a very low dose of prescription drugs in the past for anxiety. However, I've been off of them a year, and I had been on, they finally found something that was a very low dose. It was only 40 milligrams of citalopram and 5 milligrams of boost bar combination that helped the citalopram work better. And I was weaned off of it for, and that was a year ago. It took a period of 3 months to wean off. And I was doing pretty well last spring and summer and the fall, but I noticed the anxiety just got out of control again this winter. So I'm trying to decide whether to go back on the prescription. It did have some side effects that were, kind of uncomfortable. Or to try to, I've never tried your infusions before. I'd like to try something more natural because of my sensitivity to drugs anyway.
That's wonderful. So are you also using motherwort tincture?
I have not ever. No, I'm just starting. No. Motherwort?
Okay. Motherwort Leonurus cardiaca. Motherwort tincture is my favorite suggestion for anyone who deals with anxiety.
And a
droppable dose of motherwort will usually calm down anxiety within 2 to 3 minutes. It's extremely fast-acting. The more you use, the less anxious you'll be. So eventually you get to the point where you don't need it at all because you're not anxious anymore. So you can't abuse it or overuse it, and there aren't any side effects except that it's considered an herb of longevity and that it helps the heart.
Can you be more specific how I would take a motherwort tincture?
Yes. You would want to find someone who makes motherwort tincture from the fresh plant. And I know of two places that do. I'm not saying these are the only places, but they were started by past apprentices of mine, so I know of them, and that's Red Moon Herbs and Catskill Mountain Herbs. And you could probably find motherwort tincture, certainly by other people. Just be sure it's made from the fresh plant material.
Yeah.
There are great varieties of ways to dose herbal tinctures. An herbal tincture is a plant in an alcohol base, and it comes in a dropper bottle. And there are, for instance, herbal practitioners who studied in England, and they would tell you to take like a quarter of the bottle as a dose. And then there are herbalists practicing in the U.S. right now, such as Matthew Wood, and he would say that the highest dose you should ever take is 3 drops.
Hmm.
And this obviously has nothing to do with the herb itself. It's an herb in the mint family. It's completely safe. You could drink the whole bottle, and it wouldn't hurt you. It has to do with how people feel about the dosing of the herb and how much they think you really need in order to have something happen. And there are some herbs that I think we really need a lot of, like I was just talking about echinacea, and there are other herbs that I don't think we need so much of. So if you can, what I suggest is that when you're feeling anxious that you take a small amount of motherwort, like 5 drops. And if you don't feel less anxious in a couple of minutes, take another 5 drops. And keep on doing that until the anxiety is relieved. And at that point, you say, okay, I took 4 5-drop doses. The next time, I'm starting out with 20 drops. Or you might say, I don't care what that woman says. I'm just too anxious. I'm taking a drop or four right now. And that's fine, too.
Mm-hmm.
So dosing, in a way, does not matter. It's not a drug. We don't measure it in milligrams
mm-hmm.
or micrograms. It's an herb.
Mm-hmm.
Herbs are different than drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So you could keep a bottle of motherwort tincture by your bed, and you could keep a bottle of motherwort tincture in your pocket, and you could keep a bottle of motherwort tincture in your car, and you could keep a bottle of motherwort tincture where you work. And anytime you thought that you were going to have something that was going to make you anxious, or you started to feel anxious, you could take some motherwort. One of my friends had a daughter. She worked for this mean boss. And she'd come to work, and there'd be a note on her desk, "I need to see you," from the boss. And she'd say, oh, you know, her blood would run cold when she would see the note, and she would, like, tremble, and she would go into the boss's office, and sure enough, you know, she would be, like, you know, just about to have a panic attack and crying, and it's just, like, you know, it was just awful for her. And she thought she was going to have to quit the job, but she really liked the job except for the boss. And so her mom and I suggested that she take some motherwort to work, and that when she saw that note, she'd get her motherwort out, and she put some motherwort in her coffee or whatever she was drinking and drink it. And she said within a couple of weeks, she could look at that note from her boss and go, oh, yeah, fine, and just walk in and see him.
Wow.
That's what motherwort does for us.
Now, I'm
fine with you going overboard on the infusions, which is what you're doing. You're basically, you know, trying to make up for not drinking them for all this time before by drinking a whole lot right now. But you don't need to. A quart a day is really enough.
Oh, one quart of one of them a day?
Correct.
So you don't agree that taking two different ones, two of the three a day, and then, like I said, I'm alternating.
I don't think it's bad, but I don't think you need to.
I don't think I need to.
There's nothing wrong.
Well,
I'm not upset in any way, but I don't think you need to.
Okay, but if I continue to do that, it's not going to hurt.
Not going to hurt you. No, not at all.
I must be getting some benefits from it because I do feel better. I'm starting to sleep a little bit better since I've been. The oat straw seems to taste very good to me, and before bed, I like that one. And the red clover and kettle, I like more during the day.
Yes. Yes, marvelous.
Well, I could continue the program that I've been doing. In your
could
opinion,
continue
but also add the motherwort.
You've been doing that fine, and then get some motherwort tincture.
Oh, I will.
Yeah, and start working with it, kind of see what kind of dose you react to. And I also wonder if you have a meditation practice.
Been doing it. Every night, all night, when I can't sleep, during the day, whenever I can. Not too good at it.
Good for you. What an excellent thing to do when you can't sleep is to meditate. It's said that meditation is more restful and restoring than sleep.
Yes. I don't know how good I'm doing it, if there's the right way to do it. I mean, I deep breathe and I try a technique that was told to me by someone where you're supposed to hear sounds or see, there's like two different ways to do it, but I don't know what the right way is. I just keep trying.
There is no right way. What we're looking for in meditation is what's called the relaxation response.
Okay.
And just very briefly, and I hope not to bore you with this, you know, there are two kinds of nervous systems in the body. One kind of nervous system that gets us ready to run away, and a nervous system that gets us ready to relax.
Mm-hmm.
And the nervous system that gets us ready to run away makes us feel anxious. That's part of its goal. We're not supposed to look at a saber-toothed tiger and go, hi, oh, look at that cute kitty. We're supposed to go, ah, right?
Right.
We're supposed to feel anxious.
Fight or flight.
We're supposed to see a truck barreling down on us, and we're not supposed to go, oh, I wonder what kind of truck that is. We're supposed to go, oh, whoa, and move.
Yeah, I've got too much of that.
Right. So anxiety, it's a great thing. It keeps us alive. But if we can't turn on the nervous system that relaxes us, then we're always, ah, eek, ooh, ah, ee, and we're seeing threat and danger everywhere when it's not really there.
Mm-hmm.
So meditation helps us touch into the nervous system that relaxes us. By deep breathing, what we mean is really deep exhaling. And if you want something to do, and there's no right way to meditate, but if you want something to do, count while you're breathing and make your exhalations at least twice as long as your inhalation.
Okay.
Anxious people tend to go, breathe in, 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 breathe out, breathe in, breathe in, breathe in. And we want the opposite. We want breathe in, breathe out, breathe out, breathe out, breathe out, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out, breathe out, breathe out, breathe out. Because it's the breathing out that is going to bring the relaxation response.
Okay. 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 One thing that's accompanied this is constipation. I was wondering if, because it seems, you know, when I'm so anxious, then I get constipated. I've been having trouble all winter with marbles.
When you're looking to get that motherwort tincture, get yourself some yellow dock tincture and start taking 10 drops a day of yellow dock tincture. And best yet, take it in some prune juice. Yellow dock tincture. The age regularity. 10 to 15 drops once a day is all you'll need. All right, double it up with some prunes or prune juice, and I guarantee constipated you will not be.
Thank you. I'm afraid to add anything sweet to my diet, like prune juice, or that I battled dealing with candida my whole life, including after I was born, I had to be hospitalized. And a local alternative physician is advising me to stick with the lemons and maybe some lime and a little grapefruit, maybe a quarter cup of berries now and then. But whenever I do overdo I don't do any sugar at all or honey or anything. And I've been doing better since I do that and trying to push the probiotics. But I'm a little bit afraid to...
Yogurt, very important to eat your yogurt, least a quart a week.
Is it better to start with yogurt or kefir? Because I've been also avoiding dairy because
yogurt.
It makes it very mucusy.
But plain yogurt and full fat.
Oh, yes. I know about that.
Plain yogurt and fat. And, I am a big, big, big fan of yogurt. I'm a bigger fan of goat milk yogurt. But whatever you can get that's good quality, certainly... more and more research is really confirming what we have known for a very long time, that the more yogurt in the diet, the healthier the person will be. And of course, one of the things that we're starting to find out is that your anxiety is not just caused by your brain, it's caused by your gut flora.
Yes. That's what I'm trying to attack it for.
Exactly. Yogurt has a much quicker effect on gut flora than kefir does.
Oh, you do?
Oh, yes.
Yogurt is better than kefir.
I think it has a quicker effect on gut flora.
Oh, quicker.
In other words, you're going to change your gut flora faster, in my experience, by eating yogurt than by consuming kefir.
Okay. I've avoided both. Like I said, I don't seem to do well at all with dairy. It makes me mucusy, but I will try the yogurt again. Do you believe that there's any truth in determining I'm type O blood and
I just think there's no truth at all in type
diet.
Absolutely not. And if you want to see it totally debunked, go to WestonAPrice.org and green blessings. We got to say goodbye and make room for Rebecca. Who are we talking to tonight?
Thank you so much, Susan.
You are welcome.
We are talking to Sherry Samaton tonight. Do you have her information?
Sherry Samaton of LifeBridge Solutions. Is she on the line?
She may be. Let's see if this is her calling in from a different number that I have.
Okay. Sherry Samaton is the founder of LifeBridge Solutions. She has worked with hundreds of families helping older adults and their adult children deal with the challenges of aging. Sherry is a life transition coach, a certified national guardian, and a certified professional daily money manager. Sherry earned her degree in economics from Wesleyan University and went on to get her Master's of Business Administration from the Amos Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Sherry is a prolific writer and a sought-after speaker on topics related to navigating the transitions of life. And do we have Sherry with us?
Here I am.
Hi, Sherry. Welcome to my show.
Thank you so much.
You say that nobody gets out of life without dying.
That's true.
And it certainly is the end, isn't it? So,
it is.
Yes, you have a book that helps both older adults facing the end of their years and of their adult children who care for them. And that's called Facing the Finish, yes?
That's right. And it's a roadmap for aging parents and adult children.
That is so needed and so important. You know, as I'm approaching my 70th year, it is becoming, you know, more and more clear that I have got to, you know, leave some instructions as to what I want to have happen after I go. And yet it's so difficult to talk about to people.
Well, it is. It's a subject that's hard for people, but I'll also say it's not only instructions for what happens after you go, it's even perhaps more important, instructions for what happens while you're here if you can't make your own decisions.
Yes, that's quite important. I had a friend who had assigned You know, don't put me on machines, you know, don't resuscitate, all of that. But when she fell in her own home and broke her cervical vertebrae and couldn't move and was taken to, you know, a trauma care, we didn't know where her order was. It took us 8 days to find it.
Well, exactly. And that's why I tell people, it's not only the advance directives that you sign that are important, but even more importantly, the individuals you name and entrust as your healthcare surrogate or your healthcare power of attorney, because it's those people, those human beings with thoughts and feelings and brains that ultimately are going to have to interpret what the medical professionals are telling them and make decisions about what you would have wanted to occur.
But how do we make decisions before the fact? I mean, we know that human beings aren't really superb at envisioning the future. I mean, we all know the mathematical thing where we ask, you know, somebody, you could have like $10,000 right now or a penny doubled every day for the next month. Which do you want? And although we know that we're going to get more with that penny doubled every day, most people opt for the $10,000.
Well,
so how do we decide? And, you know, people have said to me, well, I know I would never take chemotherapy if I had cancer. And I say to them, you don't know that.
Well, right.
You don't
and,
know what you would do
it,
if you actually had that diagnosis. So how can we make those decisions beforehand?
Well, the first thing you have to remember is any decisions that you make, you can change them as long as you have the capacity to do so. So even though you may assert, I wouldn't want chemotherapy, and then you're diagnosed with cancer, you then, as a person with capacity can say, whoops, I changed my mind. The tricky part is if you no longer have capacity, either temporarily because you've been injured, let's say, and you're in the ICU and you're unconscious with a breathing tube, and that's different than if you have severe dementia. And so you have to think about these options and these choices in that context, I think.
Okay, I'm not, somehow I'm not feeling clearer. Maybe you could give
me an example.
I know one worked out like really well. A friend of mine had a burst blood vessel in her brain, and she was afraid of having it treated with radiation. She opted for the surgery, and she left very clear directives before that surgery as to what she wanted done, mm-hmm. so that when the surgery went bad, and it did, and a balloon blew up in her brain, it was 48 hours, and at the end of 48 hours, there was the directive, and they turned everything off.
Right. And that's
and we didn't have to struggle at all, her friends.
And that's because she was clear going into the procedure. She understood the risks and the potential harms and could make an informed decision. So she was able to give informed consent because she understood what was going on.
Right.
The difference.
But you're suggesting, and I think suggesting correctly, that at least some of us are going to wind up in a situation where, for in one way or another, we're going to be somewhat incapacitated and not able, either through not being conscious, being in a coma, or like my friend, I mean, she was conscious, but she was completely paralyzed, right? Breathing
right.
tube. I mean,
she
oh my
could,
goodness, the number of
right.
tubes and dials and things that they had on her and in her and around her was pretty scary.
Of course.
And,
I mean,
you know,
I
we tried a letterboard with a letter, and all she would say is, let me die, or let me die now.
And in that case, she was very clear on what she wanted, and
yes.
she had the capacity to make that decision. So it really wasn't confusing. But let me give you an example where it was very confusing.
Okay.
One of the things I've done is been a guardian appointed by the court to come in when there's somebody who has no family that they've named. And I had a lady, and I had to make a decision. The doctors were saying to me, look, she's in a lot of pain. We need her to be enrolled in hospice so that we can provide comfort care for her because there's really no more we can do. And as a guardian, I'm required to make the best decision that I can. But that decision is supposed to be, what would the lady have done herself if she could have told me? So how was I going to figure that out? Well, she had a brother. So I called the brother, and I talked with him. He lived several states away, and I asked him, has she ever talked about this? Has she ever mentioned it? And he said to me, she saw how our mother died, and she said she never wanted to go that way, meaning in a lot of pain. Okay, so that gave me information. But she also had a niece, this gentleman's, her brother's daughter, who was an emergency room doctor. And this young woman wanted to do everything because she was an emergency room doctor. So she wanted everything to be done to save her aunt. And she strongly discouraged me from bringing in hospice and providing comfort care. So here I was with two family members, and I had to make the best decision that I could. And that's a really tough situation, and none of us want our families to have to do that.
So she could have left a prior directive.
That's correct. So she could have said, I've seen what happened to my mother. I don't want this to happen to me. And so if it ever comes to pass that two physicians are recommending that I go to comfort care with hospice and stop aggressive treatment, then I'm in favor of that if I can't tell you myself. And that would have been hugely helpful.
Yes. So how do we get ourselves to do these things? You know, there's always so many things that we need to do in life, and this always seems like something we can put off.
Of course, because nobody wants to spend time on these kinds of issues, because we'd all rather plan on living forever and hope that we never have to actually deal with this, but that's not reality. So what I recommend that people do is actually get realistic and begin. Don't try to do it all in one day or one weekend. That's not reasonable. But set yourself a plan and say, this year I'm going to complete a life transition plan. I'm going to do it myself, I'm going to do it with a loved one, or I'm going to get some professional help. But make the decision, I'm going to take the next 6, 8, 9, 10, 12 months to put my plan together.
And what would be the components of that plan?
Well, the easy things are your getting your affairs in order, things like lists of what you have, where you keep it, account numbers, passwords, secret hiding places where you have your jewelry stashed, and those kinds of things. That's the easy part. The more difficult part is struggling with some of these big questions like, where do I want to die? What kind of interventions do I or don't I want? What kind of final wishes do I have? You know, I had one family, it was a blended family, and the gentleman passed away and he had left no instructions. And his then wife, his current wife, was only concerned that she buy the most expensive casket because of what the rest of the family, the step family, would say. And she way overspent, spent far more money than she probably ever had to, simply trying to make sure she didn't upset the extended family. And that was crazy.
And he could have left instructions about that.
That's right, or even gone so far as to make pre-arrangements with a funeral home and even made the decision to prepay for those arrangements so that everything was bought and paid for and nobody had to fight or worry about or stress over those kinds of decisions at a time that is already very, very stressful.
You know, it's so right. As I push myself to make these plans, and it's really a push, it's really difficult, I find that a lot of what's holding me back is that I don't want to hurt people's feelings.
Well, and when you say hurt people's feelings in terms of who you select as your agent, your power of attorney, your healthcare surrogate, so I have I have a solution for that. And I call it the 5A method of choosing the person or the people who will make decisions for you. And the 5A's are choose someone who is able, meaning they have the skills and the knowledge and good attention to detail. Choose someone who is affable, meaning they've got good people skills and they can get along and deal with stress. Choose someone who's available. That is, they're willing to invest the time, they're nearby, or they're able to travel, and they've got a good attitude. Choose someone who's above board, who's trustworthy and honest and professional. And finally, choose someone who's anchored. They're stable, and they have a level head, and their own life isn't a mess. And if you take those five attributes, those five A's, and think about the people that you want to name, you may be surprised at who you do decide or don't decide to name.
Well, that is fabulous advice. Thank you.
You're welcome. And don't.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to go out and see if I can find a whole bunch of friends who are able, affable, available, above board, and anchored.
Exactly.
I don't want to wait until I'm dead. That sounds like the kind of person I'd like to have around me all the time.
You're absolutely right. And you know, sometimes you may choose one person to handle your financial matters and another person entirely to handle your health care matters because they're not the same.
Correct. Correct. So I was going to ask you what a certified National Guardian is, but I think you just told us that you step in and become the guardian of someone who has not made plans, not said, I'd like this person to take care of my finances and this person to take care of my funeral, and someone who hasn't made any advanced plans. They've just kind of died and left this void, and you step in and help take care, or they haven't, and they're in this in-between place, and you step in to help.
Well, and actually, it's only when they're in the in-between place. That's when the court...
Only the in-between place that you're the...
Right.
Okay.
Right. Otherwise, if you die without a will, then each state has its own statutes about what happens to your stuff. Because at that point, it's only stuff.
Exactly.
So guardians are the ones who step in and are appointed by the court to make these important decisions while you're still here if you haven't named people and backups for those people on your own previously.
Right. And then, of course, I wanted to know what a professional daily money manager is. Do people like really call you up every day and say, can I buy a cup of coffee?
Not quite, thank goodness, but as daily money managers, we help people with the day-to-day business of life, which can be as simple as managing their financial mail, seeing that their bills are paid and their bank statements are reconciled, and their credit card bills are reconciled, those types of things, up to and including helping them create a budget, helping them stick to that budget, helping them deal with their medical bills, medical insurance, long-term care or disability insurance claims, all of what I like to call the day-to-day business of life.
Yes, the day-to-day financial responsibilities that
That
we have. I think, and please tell me if I'm wrong, I think that women are becoming more active in their own financial lives.
Oh, absolutely, and that's great news.
Yes, because I know, like in my mom's generation, like when he would die, suddenly she would like not even know how to write a check.
Well, and believe it or not, I have quite a few clients in my daily money management practice who are suddenly single, either widowed or their spouse who handled everything has dementia or in some way can no longer handle those things, and they still, in many cases, don't know how to proceed. I had one lady call me from the car dealer lot and start to tell me about the deal she was about to make, and I said, stop right now, I'm on my way. And I went and helped her negotiate for her new car because she had no idea what she was doing.
That is so wonderful that she could call you and get that help.
Well, and that's one of the fun things we get to do as daily money managers.
Yeah, so is this like a private service that people, that she had hired you privately, or how, as you can tell,
exactly.
I've never heard of this before, and I think it's wonderful.
Right, well. It's a fairly new profession. There's something called the American Association of Daily Money Managers. I happen to be on the board. We have close to 800 members around the country, and it is a private, you know, service, just like having an attorney, an accountant, a psychologist, any of those kinds of people that you pay directly. Some daily money managers do pro bono work or work for public agencies, but the majority of it is private pay.
So this is a new profession, and it's a growing profession. If it's not yet in your town, it might be. And it's somebody you hire like you would hire an accountant or a lawyer or a financial advisor.
That's exactly right, and many daily money managers work virtually. So, for example, in my case, I have clients all around the country. I have a young man who has special needs in Philadelphia that I'm just starting with this week, and I've never met him and never will, and I've never met his parents and never will. They live 3,000 miles away from me, but they were referred by a mutual contact. And so, you know, some of us are available even if you don't have somebody who lives right beside you.
All right. So it, you know, doesn't have to be that you'll come to the car dealership. You can also do it virtually. And is the best place for people to find you at www.facingthefinish.com?
Absolutely. And that's where they can also find the book. And I have a companion workbook for Facing the Finish as well, which they can download as a PDF if they click on Buy from the Author.
Wow. So if you click on Buy from the Author to buy the book, then you get a free PDF, which is the workbook, which you can print out.
That is correct. That is correct.
That is a really fantastic offer. This is Susan Weed. I'm talking to Sherry Samotin, and she is the author of Facing the Finish. And you want to find out more, go to facingthefinish.com. If you click on Buy from the Author, then you get a wonderful workbook that you can print out. What kinds of things are in the workbook? Are there the actual forms?
There are.
You know, like
so
the end-of-life care and so on?
There are. There's also things like 50 signs your aging parent needs more help or 50 signs you may need more help. So there's checklists. There's sets of questions around a lot of the issues we've been talking about, like 25 tough questions you need to answer to face your finish. So all kinds of activities, exercises, and checklists that help make the recommendations in the book itself more actionable.
Right, because, you know, again, action is what we really need here. It's easy
That's
to
right.
talk about.
It's
easier
to
talk
about
than it is
to think about.
What?
That's right.
Yeah.
I was saying,
I really, you know, that's why I'm so excited that you are, I mean, you can't come and hold people's hands and make them do it, but you can make it easy for them. And that,
well, and that's
you are, it sounds like you are really, really making it easy for people to face the finish, to understand that whether it is accidental or by disease, you are going to die. It is going to happen.
That's right. And you have the opportunity to be prepared and to prepare your loved ones in a way that will make it peaceful and as stress-free as possible for those you're leaving behind.
And I really want to thank my parents for doing that. My parents... with three children, you know, 15 years before their deaths, said, this is what we're doing. We're doing a trust. This is what's going to happen. And my dad died. A year later, my mom died. And that trust converted to us. And the whole thing was so easy. And I contrasted that to my dear friend whose husband died without a will. And their home was in his name, and it was more than 10 years before she could even sell their home.
Of course, because everything is then in complete disarray.
Right. So I really see the love in doing the advanced planning. There's so much love, so much care that we can give to each other by doing this.
Exactly, and I like to call it the best gift you can give.
Oh, that's a beautiful way to think of it. And that can give us a goal deadline, too. I want to give this to my so-and-so by their birthday, or I want to give it to them for Christmas. Because we all know that we work better if we have goals and deadlines.
You're so right. I had one about 2 or 3 years ago now. I had one client give me to his wife for Christmas. And that's exactly what he did. He said to her, I want you to work with Sherry for the next year and get this done.
Yes. So that's another way to do it, is to find someone who is going to urge you forward. And see, that has been part of my problem. I've actually been trying to do this for at least 10 years now, Sherry. I can talk from personal experience about how ooh it is, you know? Right, and I've gone to seminars, and I've, you know, gone and talked to people about trusts, and I've talked to my lawyer about it, but nobody has been breathing down my neck.
Well, and once you decide that you want to do that, what you find is that the process of doing it, especially with somebody kind of guiding you and nudging you through it, the process is as much or as valuable as the end product. Because the end product is just a static thing that goes and sits there and waits. But the process of thinking about these things and communicating with the people you care about, it actually frees you to begin making all kinds of memories, and sometimes there are unintended consequences of people starting to talk to one another again who haven't spoken in years. Or I had one client where the three daughters, who were in their 60s, had not seen one another in 20 years. And when the dad finally got them together to talk about these things, was the first time his family had been around the same table.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing.
So, you know, a lot positive can come out of this kind of a process beyond the end result itself.
Yes. Yes, and I have found it very helpful to have someone to ask me kind of hard questions. You know, when I say, well, I think this person should get this much, and they say, why? And I say, well, because it's expected or it's required. And they say, would this person's life change in any way if they got this? And if I say no, they say, well, then maybe it isn't required. And it's very interesting to see, I mean, in most aspects of my life, I don't feel like I'm doing things because I think they're required. But when it comes to this, there's a lot of that coming out.
Right, because we're afraid to upset anybody, or we're afraid to do something other than what people think we're going to do. And that's hard for lots of people.
Yeah. Yes. And it's like, and I I'm looking at myself going, my goodness, girl, you know, in your life, you just, you know, bold, and here you are making plans for your death, and you're, like, really wimping out on it.
Well, you're not alone. You're not alone.
Well, I so appreciate what you are doing, both with the individual people that you're working with and for all of us, by writing this book, by providing the workbook, by talking to us all about it. I think of it a little bit like Tai Chi. You know, my Tai Chi teacher says you get nothing from practicing Tai Chi once. But if you practice it once and once and once and once and once and once and once, you will get a lot. And so I kind of think that the more I talk about this, and the closer I am getting to actually doing it.
Well, that's so true. And each person you talk with is going to bring something different to your thought process, because we all come at this from our own perspectives.
This is Susan Weed, and you are listening to me talking with Sherry Samitin, the founder of Life Bridge Solutions. Her new book is Facing the Finish, just loaded with tips and tricks. Create dialogue between the two generations in handling the many, many dishes, decisions, and details that can very easily become overwhelming. Find Sherry Samitin and Facing the Finish at facingthefinish.com. Click on Buy from the Author, and you will get that wonderful, wonderful PDF of a workbook you can print out. And Sherry, please, to give my guests the last minute, and we literally are going to be cut off in 55 seconds here. What do you want to leave them thinking about?
That the most important thing to do is to constantly make memories. Make this fun. Don't make it oh so serious, but get it done.
Make it fun and get it done. Those are great words for us to take to bed and to wake up tomorrow facing the finish. Thank you, Sherry Samitin, for being here with me, Susan Weed, to reweave the healing cloak of the ancients. Green blessings, everyone.